8. I checked in with the sheriff's office while I was in town, stopped by the local newspaper office, even quizzed some of the neighbors gathered around to watch the filming. I was impressive to the neighbors because I seemed to be somehow involved with ghost pursuers, and I took advantage of that, getting them to open up and talk more intimately and honestly than they would have otherwise. But it had been a long time, and the truth was that I knew more about Frank than anyone else I met. The reputation of the haunted houses might have spread all the way to Hollywood, but Frank was practically unknown even in his own town. I returned to California, disappointed by how little I'd learned, yet at the same time filled with an even firmer resolve to connect the dots, to find out how, why, and where he was building these houses with stolen materials and buried bones. I remembered George and Betsy saying that Frank had changed after he went to Vietnam, that he was somehow darker. What did that mean? And what was that part of Frank's journey? As soon as I got back, Terry wanted to know about my trip, and I thought about telling her the truth, but in the end, I didn't. To protect her, I told myself. But I was not sure that was it, or at least not entirely. It was a small club, the people whose lives had been affected by Frank, and an exclusive one. And I didn't think anyone outside that circle could really understand the truth of what it meant to have lived in a Frank house. Sure, I could describe it and try to explain it, but Terry would still be on the outside, and I wanted her to stay that way. I thought back to what I'd seen in Randall, experiencing the sort of supernatural encounter that had been only hinted at before, had invigorated me, and I vowed to track Frank down. For my brother, for my parents, for me. The best place to start was obviously with the houses. Frank had never used a real estate agent, apparently, so I couldn't track him down that way, but property tax records were easy enough to obtain, and though the going would be slow, I figured I'd be able to find him eventually if I stuck with it. The problem was that he probably used a different surname each time, and it was nearly impossible to track down just a Frank. He could also move anywhere in the country. The only leads I had were the fact that he seemed to keep using a last name that began with W, and Sandy Simmons' hunch that Frank and Irene had moved to Las Vegas after selling their house in Tarzana. So I spent my spare time doing research. Although, as luck would have it, I didn't have much spare time. The real estate business ebbs and flows, and for one of those unknown reasons entirely unrelated to other economic conditions, our office caught a wave. All of our agents were suddenly listing and showing and selling, and as quickly as it had come, my dry spell evaporated. I knew it wouldn't last, knew I had to strike while the iron was hot, so as much as I wanted to pursue Frank, I pushed that aside and got busy selling. It had been over 3 decades, and a few more weeks wouldn't make much difference. Still, whenever I had an extra moment, I made phone calls, sent emails, looked up records. I sometimes thought it was stupid and pointless, and I didn't completely understand the sudden need, after all these years, to chase Frank down, but something had been awakened within me. I was not, by any stretch of the imagination, a religious person, and I didn't believe in fate or mystical signs, yet I couldn't help ascribing some import to the fact that I had sold that Big Bear cabin to a man who had grown up in a Frank house. I wouldn't go so far as to say that I thought there was a reason it had happened, but I had been made aware that Frank had continued on after Randall, doing the same thing elsewhere, and I had to follow up on that. I had to know. I found myself wondering if Sandy Simmons had any paperwork from when she and her husband had bought the house from Frank, thinking the title transfer alone might give me some information to work from, and I called to ask. She wasn't answering, but I left a voicemail and told her to call me back at her earliest convenience. Fudging the truth a little, I hinted that the reason for the call had something to do with her son's purchase of the cabin, thinking that it might make the call seem more urgent. It was Brad who called me back, nearly 2 days later. I could tell from the tone of his simple greeting, "This is Brad Simmons," that he was distracted and upset by something far more important than a glitch in his sales paperwork. "Thanks for returning my call," I told him. "But actually, I Needed to speak with your mother. She's not here, he said, and the hesitation that followed let me know that he wasn't sure whether he wanted to tell me any details. She's in the hospital, he said finally. Oh my God, I said. What happened? Another pause. The house collapsed while she was sleeping. The roof just fell in on her. Is she all right? She's in a coma. It was the Frank influence. I knew it in my bones. Bones. Though there was no way in hell I could prove it to anyone. I shivered. I'm sorry, I said. I hope she gets better. I had no idea if that was stupid and insensitive to say under the circumstances, but it was the only thing that came to me. I found myself wondering how the roof had collapsed. In my mind, I saw it spontaneously crumpling at a focal point directly above Sandy's bed. It was, I realized, the second time the house had tried to kill her. What were you calling about? Brad asked. What did you need? It sounded like it's nothing, I assured him. Just a question I had, and it's already been taken care of. I'm sorry to bother you at a time like this. Really. Everything's fine. Okay. He didn't sound entirely convinced, but I swore again that there were no last-minute problems with the sale and promised to call him if anything came up. Don't worry about a thing on this end, I told him. Just take care of your mom. I hung up, feeling shaky. The talk of houses left me wondering once again what had happened to the good ones. Had Mark and his family endured accidents and problems and tragedies like everyone else who'd lived in a Frank house? I had a feeling they had, and part of me wanted to know the details, but part of me didn't. I decided to put off looking for Mark until I could gain some emotional distance. Hearing about Sandy Simmons had shaken me, and while it could have been a completely random accident, unconnected to anything else, I didn't think that was the case. At the very least, it was Frank's poor construction skills that had led to the roof's collapse, and whether or not there was a supernatural element involved, it was still Frank's doing that had led to this. I redoubled my search efforts, and they finally began to pay off. A Frank Watson in a town called Biscuitville, Texas, had transferred ownership of his house to someone else in 1976. A Frank Wilson in Bernalillo, New Mexico, had sold his small ranch house in 1982. Someone named Frank Wilton had bought, remodeled, and sold a fixer-upper in Las Vegas in 1993. I found 8 homes altogether. 8 possibilities. There were pictures of most of these properties from subsequent sales with legitimate realtors, and from all of them, I got the same vibe I got from Frank's Randall house. From our vacation home, from Sandy Simmons' place, the sense that there was something off, something wrong, something weird. Were all of these Franks him? And which, if any, was his real last name? George and Betsy would know if... George and Betsy. I stared at my computer screen. Of course. George and Betsy. I thought for a moment. There'd been no bodies in that propane explosion, and knowing the Randall's Sheriff's Department, even if they had tried to track down the couple, they probably hadn't put too much effort into it. It was quite possible they were still alive somewhere. They'd both be old, really old, but if they were alive, I still might be able to track them down. I knew their last name, Robertson, and while it wasn't that unique, there probably weren't too many George and Betsy Robertsons who were married to each other. Unless they'd changed their names, too. I slumped in my chair, disappointed. Of course they had. Still, it couldn't hurt to check. And I spent a couple of hours using every program, app, and website at my disposal to try and find them. Nothing. Feeling defeated, I scrolled back through the real estate photos I'd saved. They definitely seemed like Frank houses. They had that feeling, though no two looked alike. The one in Texas was two stories and sort of Victorian-looking. It seems far too professionally built to be all Frank, and I wondered if he'd been working for a construction company at the time, or if he'd simply remodeled an already existing structure. The one in Las Vegas was little more than a shack, a small ramshackle one-story building that reminded me of a third-world slum dwelling. He could have definitely built that. One, in Pocatello, Idaho, was a double-wide trailer with an added-on carport. Like George and Betsy's. I stared at the picture. The more I thought about George and Betsy, the more suspect they seemed to be. First, there was that story about them living in Phoenix and buying our original lot as an investment. They hadn't lived in Phoenix. We'd found out from the sheriff. They'd been longtime residents of Randall, and Betsy had been a secretary at the town hall. So why had they lied? And why had they bought the lot, and why had they sold it? Then, there was that thing about Frank in Vietnam, how he'd come back changed. Maybe he had. But if he actually was Frank Watson, he hadn't come back to Randall, but to Biscuitville, Texas, and had apparently moved to several states in between. There was also the mysterious explosion that had destroyed the Robertsons' trailer. Had they said it? Had Frank said it? Why? And why had they disappeared after that? I wondered if either of them were even related to Frank or Irene. The confusing part was that there seemed to be threads of truth woven through the lies, so it was impossible for me to tell where the lies ended and the truth began. Between showing houses, I kept up my search. I'm not sure when exactly I decided to take a leave of absence, but I started calculating expenses vis-a-vis my bank account, and at some point made the decision that I could afford to take some time off and check out some of these Frank houses in person. I needed to see them for myself, and I honestly thought I might be able to ascertain his whereabouts, or his fate if he were dead, from what I might learn by visiting those locations and talking to people who'd been entangled with him. It had become an obsession, this search. I realized that, understood it on an intellectual level, but on an emotional level, it was still something I felt compelled to do. All of my feelings involving Frank had been bottled up since Billy's accident, since the deaths of my dad and my mom, and everything had started leaking out when I learned that Brad had grown up in a Frank house, that I was not the only one, that the man had kept on doing what he did long after Randall. I told myself that I might be in a position to not only see that he was punished for his past crimes, but make sure that he was stopped so he could never do it again. I made an itinerary. The houses were literally all over the map, and if I were going to do this, I had to decide how I wanted to proceed, where I wanted to go first. I could visit the houses in chronological order, or in reverse chronological order, or closest to farthest, or farthest to closest. Eventually, I decided to begin with Las Vegas. It was the one real lead I had, the one house, thanks to Sandy Simmons, that I was almost positive was his, and it happened to be the one nearest Southern California. I hadn't seen Terry for almost a week, and I felt guilty about that. We'd kept in contact primarily by text, talking only once or twice over the phone. Our last actual meeting had not even been a date or a dinner or a long conversation, but a quickie in the bathroom of the real estate office at lunch on Monday. She needed it, I needed it. We had a very limited amount of time, so she dropped by when everyone else was out. We locked the bathroom door. I pulled her pants down, slipped on a condom, bent her over the sink, and took her quickly from behind. She was gone before anyone else in the office returned. If I was going to be gone for a while, I needed to tell her, and I needed to do so in person rather than over the phone, or through a text or email. I owed her that much. We met at a Chili's located in the parking lot of a mall. Inside, the place was crowded. On the opposite side of the restaurant, as we walked in, waitresses were singing happy birthday to an old man surrounded by his family. The waitresses presented the old man with a brownie topped by a single burning candle. "Make a wish," his family exhorted him. "Make a wish." We sat down in a booth suggested by the overenthusiastic server. I'd always hated restaurants like this, but they were part and parcel of the world I lived in, the glad-handing realm of real estate. And not for the first time, I wondered how I had ended up in this life. It was probably because of Billy. Probably because of Frank. But there was time enough later to feel sorry for myself and bemoan my off-track existence. Right now, I needed to let Terry know that I would be gone for a while. I need to go on a business trip, I lied. Where? She asked, curious. Nevada? Maybe Texas? New Mexico? Road trip? She said. Sounds like fun. The expression on her face was one of eager anticipation, and I realized with a sinking feeling that she thought I was inviting her. Not knowing how to tell her that I didn't want her to come with me, I said, It won't be fun, and I'm not sure how long I'll be gone. That's okay. I thought you couldn't get time off. Things have calmed down. It's a slack time for us, and I have plenty of vacation days saved up. The waitress stopped by to take our order, animatedly introducing herself and rattling off an impossibly long list of specials. Terry ordered a chicken fajita platter and a margarita, while I just asked for a side order of French fries and an iced tea. Are you sure? The waitress prodded. We have. I'm sure, I said. You don't? I'm not hungry. Terry waited until the waitress left. Not hungry? She grinned mischievously. I bet I know something you'd like to eat. Her eyes glanced almost imperceptibly down at her lap, and I laughed. I was going to miss her sense of humor when I was gone. A sharp, small pang of melancholy told me that I was going to miss more than that. And I realized that despite my determination to keep this relationship light and casual, within the past few months, it had somehow developed into something deeper. Maybe she should come with me. No. I liked Terry. A lot. Which was why I didn't tell her about my real mission. I needed to protect her. Keep her out of it. And, in a weird way, I needed her to be a kind of anchor. To keep me grounded. To maintain my connection with the real world of jobs and relationships and practical matters, so I didn't go floating off permanently into the nebulous world of quests and ghosts and the mysteries of Frank. Besides, I might not come back. I don't know what made me think that, but as soon as I did, I realized that the possibility had always been at the back of my mind. It was behind the feeling of sadness that had been dogging me all day, and it was the real reason I was reluctant to get Terry involved. I was not sure if I thought there was the possibility of physical danger, or if I thought something might happen that would cause me to abandon my life and career and never return, but I was filled with the sense that a big change was coming, that after this, my life would never be the same. It took a while, but I eventually dissuaded her from coming with me, convincing her to save her vacation days so that we could take a real trip, a fun trip. The next day, I called around to find the best deal on the smallest rental car possible, knowing that I might need it for a while. There were some loose ends that needed to be tied up, both at work and at home, and it was another week before I was actually ready to take off. Officially, I would be on leave for 1 month. But there was the understanding that it could be extended. I shifted my listings and in-process sales to May Lam and Mike Rivera, dividing the workload based on who I thought would do a better job with each individual property, and made sure that everyone in the office had my cell number in case they needed to get in touch with me for anything. After deleting information so there was nothing private on my computer, I gave Mike my password should anyone need to access my files. I spent that night at Terry's, and we tried things we'd never tried before. She couldn't possibly guess what was really going on, but I think she understood that I was not actually going on a business trip, and she made me promise that I would call and text her every morning and every evening. It was almost as though she, too, had a premonition of danger. But neither of us spoke of that, and we parted the next morning with a kiss, the way we always did. For a brief moment, looking out at her through the driver's side window of the car, I considered inviting her to accompany me. and I could tell that she would say yes. But I knew this was something I needed to do alone. Waving, I drove off, headed home, packed my bags, and started for Las Vegas.